When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
This is the Analyzing Anfield podcast on the Blood Red Channel, bringing you the best tactical and statistical analysis of Liverpool FC.
Hello and welcome to Analyzing Anfield, this week's Analyzing Anfield. Mo, I'm joined by you as always, mate. It is a rainy day.
It is a rainy day. If people who can't see what your hoodie looks like can't tell. But yeah, it's kind of that period of the year, isn't it, where you wake up and it's already raining and it makes you feel a little bit grim. And you come in here and you want to talk about a game and it's almost like, well, we didn't win, so maybe there's that grimness fills in the disappointment. But we know better than that. There's good and bad in everything, and I think we're going to be able to find both in this one.
Yeah, well, apologies to the people who are watching on YouTube because I'm not actually wearing a polka dot hoodie. It just looks like that because I'm absolutely soaked. But this is the dedication that this is the commitment that we've made, mate, coming to the office again.
And you know what? We're going to see the benefits of that commitment of course in the next 30 or 40 minutes.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm for that 30 and 40 minutes. We can go in a few different directions, really, can't we? We're obviously going to touch on Brighton, a few talking points around that. I think Alexis McAllister is a bit of a talking point at the minute. And then I think it also gives us a bit of scope now to kind of reflect on the season so far. And obviously, international break at the minute, you know, where do Liverpool stand, where do our rivals stand, and things like that. So, yeah, we can definitely get into that. But in terms of the Brighton game, obviously, we previewed it last week. What did you think?
I think it was fascinating how many of the things that we said were going to happened. Like, we mentioned a lot about press baiting and about how both teams want to do it, and it was almost going to be who's going to be able to blink first. Well, literally, we both blinked because three of the four goals came from exactly that. Yeah. But the way that we did it, I wasn't quite expecting in terms of the kind of narrow diamond system that we used. And we've seen Liverpool use diamonds before, but this was a little bit different because rather than having like central midfielders on either side, we had wingers. Well, Harvey Elliott is technically was playing as a midfielder, but he's got like forwards instincts. So it was a slightly different way of doing it. And for a while, it was weird because Brighton clearly weren't expecting it and we got a lot of joy out of it. But then as the game went on, you could see that they were starting to enforce their will upon us. And then it almost flipped. I'd say around 67, maybe 25 minutes ago, Brighton was starting to impose their will on us and we weren't really able to deal with it in quite as good a way. And again, you could get a situation where both teams felt like they probably should have capitalised more when they were on top and both would come away thinking, we probably could have won that game, but neither did.
Yeah, it was a difficult game to analyse, to be honest. We will touch on a diamond in a sec. But in terms of like the makeup of the game, particularly in the first half, I thought personally that we showed them too much respect almost. To the extent where like I tweeted at half time actually that it feels like Klopp and Linders were watching clips of Brighton all week and just growing in admiration for what they're doing. And then as a result of that you almost turn up a little bit nervy of being embarrassed by them to an extent. So I thought it was interesting. I thought we'd go in there and really try to press them into the ground, like Klopp 2.0, revitalised, much younger age of the squad. But we didn't really. I felt we were kind of a bit calculating in the way we were doing it to ensure that even if we don't regain the ball, we don't get opened up as the first priority.
Yeah, I think it was trying to do it by maintaining that compactness. And I think that's why we obviously we mentioned the diamond, that's where it came in. But also other things that I noticed, like the way that Virgil was so keen to come into midfield anytime the ball got anywhere near João Pedro. He wanted João Pedro to feel his breath on his neck for 90 minutes. And he probably did until he came off. And again, that comes to squeeze the centre of the pitch. And so I'm like you, I thought that we were going to be more intense about it, but it was almost like, it felt like we were trying to pick our moments. It also felt like, and this is something that we might see, particularly at the start of the season where everyone's getting used to it, some of the players felt like they were trying to, they had too many things to think about at the time. It was less an instinctive see ball, attack ball, win ball. It was more like, well, okay, he's got the ball there, but okay, I can't go over that side because then he'll do that. So it was almost like they were kind of being more cautious about it because it's like, okay, I've got to think of this and think of this and think of this at all times. And the times we were able to simplify it, like there was a few times when we got overloads over on the right side, we got Diaz coming from the left over to the right side to create like a little net. And when we were able to do that and pin them in there, that's where it really started to work. And again, you could see the benefits of what we were trying to do, but I'm like you, I think that we probably could have upped the intensity a little bit, particularly when the second half changed.
Yeah, as I said, it felt like the first priority was to not get opened up and the second priority maybe was to regain the ball. And I think usually we're a little bit reversed on that with the view of if we do get opened up, Virgil will just deal with it.
Yeah.
But I think this time around, because we were conscious of Brighton being so good at it and I've got so many players up top that you've got to deal with at once, I think we were a bit more conscious of that.
The other thing about it as well, I think, and you got to see it a couple of times when it did break down, because of the way we were trying to overload on the right side, you ended up having like Joel Matip really far on the right hand side, Mo Salah really far on the right hand side further up, and then you'd have Harvey Elliott to drift over to kind of create a wall pass when they were trying to come out. So you had these guys over close and it worked and it was great. But then if you got out past Harvey and if McAllister had come up, he had a lot of space to cover and he's not the quickest.
Yeah.
And Harvey's not the quickest. And there was a couple of times in that first half where both Harvey and McAllister had to turn and run back to their own goal. And you could literally see on their faces, it was just a bit like, did not really want to be doing this. And maybe that's why Klopp was so cautious, because he knows that of his three midfielders, he's got two of them who, let's face it, aren't the quickest. But we'll come to that in a little bit.
Well, that was one of the things I was conscious about going into the game, to be honest. I was a bit surprised he selected Elliott, if I'm honest, to start. Mainly because the guy who's just come out is Curtis Jones, and he plays on the left and he's right-footed, and Elliott plays on the right and he's left-footed. So to accommodate Elliott, you're moving Szoboszlai, which we had to do. So I didn't think Klopp would go through that change. I thought he would keep Szoboszlai where he is and maybe either bring in an Endo for McAllister and move McAllister forward, or take out Jones for Gravenberch as a straight swap.
Yeah.
But he didn't do either, surprised us a little bit. And one of the concerns I did have about that was what you just said, the recovery pace a little bit. Of if you look at that as a three, you've got one absolute marathon man and you've got two lads who, once they are bypassed, they're out the game.
Yeah.
So to have two like that, I thought was a bit of a risk. But the way in which we stayed compact, it didn't hurt as much. I can't think of many opportunities where Brighton were, where our back four was exposed with a man running at us. I think there was one moment where Belaibe was doing that. He had a shot from outside the box. But other than that, I really can't think of many opportunities where we were opened up, and that's a massive positive compared to the last time we were there.
Yeah, and I think, again, because of, like you say, what happened last time and the way that we suspected Brighton were going to attack us, that was higher up the priority list than it would have been normally. And, yeah, I'm like you. I probably would have done a straight swap with Gravenberch. But, again, I don't know whether or not Klopp had already decided that he wanted to do this diamond and he wanted Szoboszlai as close to the forwards as he can get, so therefore the midfield's going to look different anyway, or whether or not it was one that precipitated the other. The difference between the lack of personnel available and how much that dictates the tactics, on vice versa. I think that's something that you see a lot with Liverpool, that there are times when we decide on a tactic, whether it's for a team or whether it's for a run of games, we're almost as if to say, okay, this is the tactics and whatever players we've got can come in and do jobs here and there. And sometimes you get into situations where you're looking at the tactics and you're looking at the personnel on the pitch and thinking, we aren't getting the best out of them. There are ways that, like with these particular players, this is not the best way to go. And I think that kind of came up a couple of times against Brighton, where, particularly in the second half, where suddenly they were able to get out wide and get balls in behind fullbacks, particularly when Gomez came on. And they kind of did what I was hoping we would do to them. Like, if you remember last week, we talked about having a front five up against them to kind of stretch them and stop their attacking players having to get so much time on the break. Well, they kind of did that to us. And it really worked.
Anfield on the Blood Red Channel.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Well, I think the big kind of like analysing Anfield talking point from the game is obviously the diamond.
Yes.
I think that was interesting. I'm annoyed that we didn't touch on it last week because we used the diamond last time we went there. But at the time, because we got hammered 3-0, I thought it would get scrapped.
Yeah.
So I thought it was really interesting that we turned up again with a diamond. And I thought that was kind of a bit of a signal, a bit of an indicator from Klopp's side, saying, listen, that plan last season was good. We're reusing that plan. The problem was the players executing the plan, specifically in the midfield. At the time, we had Thiago as a number 10, which makes me stomach churn. We had Ox in the team, Henderson as the 2-8s, and then the 6 was Fabinho. Average age of that 4, I think, is just over 29, 30, something like that.
Yeah.
This time around in the diamond, we had McAllister at the base, Szoboszlai at the tip, and the 2-8s. The 2-8s, believe it or not, was Harvey Elliott and Luis Diaz.
Yeah.
That's very experimental, but it was really interesting, wasn't it?
But this is the thing, right? You basically kind of laid out the problem, because you said that Klopp is a believer of this plan. Clearly, he thinks that the diamond is the best way to stop what Brighton do.
Yeah.
And he was like, okay, well, it didn't work last time because we didn't have the right personnel. So are Harvey Elliott and Luis Diaz going to be better attacking eights than Jordan Henderson and Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain? Yeah. Like, I'm not sure they are.
Yeah.
So again, you think about, okay, Ryan Gravenberch. Like, if we're going to play this way, it feels like it's kind of tailor-made for him to be one of them.
And other thing as well is, Gravenberch, Ajax, diamond, it just works, doesn't it? When you think of a diamond shape, you think of Ajax, mate, so he'll surely be really familiar with that shape.
And when he did come on in the second half, he was playing slightly a different role. Like, he was in the left side, but his job was to kind of stay a little bit deeper for the most part. There were times when he was kind of freed up to overlap outside, but for the most part, it was about trying to hold that shape, and Klopp was still really worried about the breakthrough in the middle. So it was a slightly different way of doing it once he came on. So again, it feels like the tactics for that personnel, again, you maybe just swap them around a little bit. And there was a moment in the game where I was thinking, okay, this is the Mac Ferrando time. This is where Mac's done his job there. He's done very well in terms of being able to recycle the ball because his passing percentage was actually still really high against Brighton in that game. But it's time you need a bit more energy in there. Brighton were very clever, and again, you said that you were gutted you didn't mention the diamond. I was going to mention Carlos Baleba last week because this is what Brighton do, right? They wait until Liverpool arrive and then they unleash this secret weapon.
Cause he was very good.
He was very good. They did the same thing with Enoch Mwepo. It was his very first Premier League start against Liverpool at Anfield, and he impressed really, really. Like, I remember going away from that game thinking, this kid's going to be a star. Unfortunately, he had a heart problem, so he had to retire. But they did it again. This was Baleba's first Premier League start, and I looked at them in midweek, and when I saw he didn't play 1 minute, I knew this was coming. I knew this was coming, because he literally saved his legs for this specific game.
I was going to say then, to be fair, you could tell that he'd had the week off.
Yeah.
Because he absolutely covered ground like it was nothing.
Exactly.
Looks like a good player, and De Zerbi said after the game, he's a great replacement for Casado.
Yes.
And which is not an easy player to replace.
No, and I mean, this is the thing where people always say, how did Brighton do it? How do they do it? Well, what they do is that they take a risk on players. Because I looked at Baleba when he was at Lille, when we were obviously scouring the world for defensive midfielders. He was one I looked at. And I thought, he's got some of the goods. Like he's aggressive in the tackle and he's very good at, when he gets the ball, playing it simple. But he's still raw. He still comes out of position loads. Like they were able to get in behind him loads. He's ill-disciplined and all those kind of things. So you think probably not the kind of guy for Liverpool. What does he do? He goes to Brighton. And what did Brighton do? They let him sit there and watch for 6 weeks or so, get into grips with what they want to do, and then they unleash him. They have the time and the patience to do that. We don't. And that's the difference.
Yeah. He looks tailor-made for the Premier League. He looks really physical. As I said, he can cover ground really easily and that, and he looks quite technical as well. So he's definitely one to watch. But yeah, in terms of the diamond, I mean, for our YouTube viewers, maybe we can get up a graphic now. We'll have a word with production after the show for that. But obviously, that's the kind of... That's the way in which I'm showing Mo now, the diamond that we used. And I think it was interesting in terms of why Klopp used that, because it allowed us to do certain things. I mean, if you think of Brighton now and the way in which they play, it's very progression through the centre.
Yes.
With De Zerbi, it's very like 1-2s, little cute passes around the corner, 5-yard passes, and it's kind of, you know, the centre backs attract the press and then they just play around you really, but using the centre of the pitch. So if you're using the diamond, you kind of cover the middle of the park, get that kind of blocked almost.
Yes.
And overloaded, and almost forced them down the flanks. A few teams have done this. Liverpool obviously did it last season. Man United did it a couple of weeks back, but they got hammered on the back of it. Didn't really do it particularly well.
No.
And obviously you mentioned Van Dijk earlier as well. One thing I think was interesting with this diamond was, because we had the makeup of the midfield like that, Brighton play with two strikers really. One plays as a 10, but they play with two strikers in Joao Pedro and Evan Ferguson. So with McAllister, Van Dijk and Matip, we kind of got an overload on the two of them. Van Dijk, as you say, every time Pedro went in, Van Dijk went with him. It was like a man-marking job.
Yeah.
But because of the way in which that worked out, that then allowed us to go basically man-marking with Matoma and Adingra, is he?
Yeah.
On the opposite side, with Robertson and Trent. So as a kind of pressing structure, I liked it.
Yeah.
It did make plenty of sense, and it felt weird initially because the last time we used it we got battered, but this time around I think tactically as a chessboard thing you could see the logic with it.
Yeah, and the beauty of the overload, as you mentioned, when you've got Mac and the two centre-halves, is it allows Virgil to go in, and more often than not Virgil's good enough to go in there and win the ball, and if he wins the ball he's got McAllister 5 yards away, who can then see the picture in front of him and see which pass he needs to play and execute it. If it's not, he doesn't win it straight away, then there's a second ball there and he's still favourite to go in there and pick it up. And what we saw was there was quite a few times where Mac was able to turn in and around the centre circle and drive forward, and then we were able to get runners going off him, and that's kind of that's the key to the plan. And then you have situations where, as I mentioned before, sometimes Diaz would come over from one side and overload the other side. So we would look to progress the ball down the right-hand side to Salah, sometimes even get Alisson up into the build-up play. So he's basically standing alongside the centre-halves, allows everyone to shift over. And then if we don't create a chance out of that, if they win the ball back, we're already in that kind of position. So if they then win the ball back, they can't come straight through us. They've got to kind of go that way or try and go over the top and go to the wide. And for a while it did work. But the problem with that is that it requires a lot of discipline from everybody involved. And particularly, as we were saying before, when you've got guys who are forwards who are playing as eights, that natural instinct to be a forward is always going to take over. So there's going to be times when they're maybe going to try and steal a few extra yards here and there, and then suddenly the space gets a little bit too big. And as we mentioned before, when you've got Mac and you're asking him to cover a lot of ground left and right, he's not as good. Like, we'll probably talk a little bit more when we go on about Mac and about the difference between doing that position when he's got Moises Caicedo next to him, and doing that position when he's got a range of either Virgil or Trent or whoever it is as his double pivot partner. I think the time he looked the best in that position was when he actually had Endo next to him. And again, if you think about the makeup of what Endo does on the pitch and the makeup of what Caicedo was doing with them, it's probably the closest.
Yeah.
Analyzing Anfield on the Blood Red Channel.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I mean, you mentioned Diaz there. I actually think if you look at the makeup of the system and what we acquired from that player in the game, like Diaz was, it was still 4-3-3 in attack. Liverpool still played the same way in attack, really. But defensively, that was when we adopted the diamond. But if you think of what that involves the player being a wide forward with the ball, and without the ball, he has to be an eight. I think Gakpo would have started in that role, but he didn't because he was suspended.
Yeah.
Wrongly suspended.
Yeah.
So, very frustrating, but that was why we ended up seeing Diaz as a midfielder, which is, you know.
Well, I mean, no, Gakpo was injured, isn't he? So,
yeah. But I think Jota would have also played, as Nunes in this game, just simply because of the pressing thing. And I think Gakpo would have played as Diaz, and I think Diaz and Nunes would have been on the bench with a view to coming on 60 minutes. Mm-hmm. And maybe winning a game for us, but
I definitely think we miss Diogo Jota. If you think about the role he's played for Liverpool so far, like I mentioned it last week, he's kind of the closer. He's the guy who comes in the last 5 minutes when it's been a bit close and we need to hold on to a lead. He scores the second goal, or the clinching goal. We could have done with that.
Yeah.
And there was a good period where at 2-1, where we did create a few chances. Obviously, Gravenberch hits the bar, but there's a few other opportunities we got in. And I just think that with Jota, his instincts are, he's able to kind of, sometimes it takes him about 5 or 10 minutes to get up to the temperature of a game. But once he's up to it, then he finds the gaps and he finds the places to be for the ball to fall to him in a way that like no one else in the team does. And that's how he's able to get those chances. And when you think about the way that the game went with Brighton, obviously to get more encouragement from their equaliser, and then, as I said before, imposing their will on us and playing with five up. If you've got someone like Jota who's still in the attacking spaces, they have to honour him because they know that he's intelligent and we still had pace on the pitch. So if he is in space, then he can go and deliver. So it just makes their job a little bit harder if they're having to worry about what we're doing. Whereas I felt like all of our changes were reactive. Like Matip for Konate, that was clearly a pre-planned. Like we talked about last week. About the idea of Matip playing that many 90s is not the plan. So when you can change...
I think the Trent one was looked pre-planned as well.
Yeah, it did. And again, normally it wouldn't have been such an issue, but unfortunately, as we said a couple of weeks ago with Joe Gomez, he's very good.
Yeah.
When he's bad, you just got to basically cross your fingers and hope for the best. And he did not have his greatest cameo.
No,
I think it's fair to say.
It was a terrible cameo, understatement, yeah. But you mentioned McAllister there. I think he's an obvious talking point from the game. I think your favourite podcast has probably already talked about this. It's a popular talking point in the Liverpool fan base at the minute. But what's the Anfield Anfield take on this, Mo? Because I think everyone's getting a bit carried away, as usual.
Yeah, I mean, my instinct straight away from looking at the game, if you think about the beginning of the Wolves game, and then if you think about this game, and even a little bit of the game in midweek, there are question marks around McAllister playing as the deepest player. And I think the question marks are based around the traps that other teams are setting for him. So that means that when he's receiving the ball from either centre-backs or goalkeeper, they are using that as a trigger to press, and then he's finding himself swamped. That's literally what happened for Brighton's first goal. Now, there are ways around that. The way that we chose to get around it was in the second half, it was Gravenberch who was picking the ball up, who's a lot bigger and stronger and can deal with those kind of situations. Previously, we've had Curtis Jones doing it, same thing. When we tried Trent doing it, that didn't work either. Mm-hmm. He got caught at Bournemouth in exactly the same way. So you've got, if we want to play the diamond, we want to have either one of Mac or Trent as the more deeper guy. They're going to have to learn how to do that. In the meantime, we're going to have to find ways around it. And I think, again, we saw enough evidence in this game as to why we want McAllister as the deepest midfielder. I mentioned when you've got the ball, if you're winning the ball in and around the centre circle, and you've got a guy like him who can see passes straight away, it's fantastic. I think physicality is an issue though.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it is, right? For some reason, whenever we decided who's playing the six, we're like, oh, he's at six, it's fine, everyone else go off, you do what. We're always, always asking the guy to do that job a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And it feels like we don't have to do that. Like, and there are times when you can look at a plan and say, okay, with these personnel, this plan looks fantastic.
Mm.
If you just change two of this personnel, suddenly it looks very different.
Yeah.
And how much of it is we're still early, we're still trying to teach everyone to do it, so you're like, I want to put them in as many different situations and see how they react. But sometimes it's like, look, without Curtis Jones, it's a lot harder job. Mm. It's a lot harder job because you really get to see how much covering and how many fail-safes they are with him in the side. And then you take him out, it becomes a lot harder job.
Yeah, it's an assistant talking point. For me, I think it's been absolutely entirely predictable. Exactly the way he's performed, the good and the bad, and the criticisms he's getting so far. I think it was so obvious to see that this was going to happen. Not in a bad way or a good way, really. Just I think it was just so predictable. In the summer, we talked about this as a possible idea, because the ongoing narrative on Twitter and things like that was like, McAllister can play as a six. And when people say this, you got to be really careful when you say that, because people said that about Gravenberch as well. What do you mean when you say that? Because just because a player has played as part of a two doesn't mean he can play as a six.
Mm.
Because McAllister was always going to have to play. If he was going to play as a two for Liverpool, that means when Liverpool didn't have possession, he was going to be a lone six.
Yeah.
And that was always my concern. I always said, as a two, if you're playing an actual two all the time, like a 4-2-3-1 with and without the ball, fine. But if at times he is a six, situational lone six, he will get exposed, he will be chasing shadows, he will look a bit like Fabinho at times because he's not the quickest and you know, he hasn't got the anticipation maybe of Fabinho in the defensive sense. He's a bit more of an attacking, creative player. So I think we've got exactly what we expected in terms of, like, with the ball, we've got positives from him. And he's even set up the odd goal with, like, the Nunes volley and things like that. But without the ball, I think he's been good, by the way, you know, without the ball. But I think one of the issues is when he's beaten, he's out the game. And if he tries something, this is the crucial part as well, I think if he tries something on the ball, which is, it's in his nature to try things because it's the type of player he is, if he loses the ball then, last season, Caicedo would then extinguish the fire. Now, if he tries something in that deep area and it doesn't come off, he knows it's my responsibility to regain this immediately. And he gives away a foul.
Yeah.
And he's, I think he's third in the league at the minute for fouls per 90. He's got four yellow cards already, one away from a suspension. And that, I think a lot of those have been desperate attempts to recover a situation.
Yeah, and I think that's it. It's not just the number, it's how they've come about. Because, again, I think if you look at most teams, you're going to expect the guy who plays the most defensive or the deepest midfielder is the most likely to commit fouls and pick up yellow cards. But it's the nature of them and the fact that they're all so similar and they're all because, like you say, he's been caught out. And the Caicedo example is really applicable because, for starters, Caicedo's probably looking like he's probably missing Mac a little bit as well, if you think about the way that Chelsea have been playing. And you can also see why Klopp was trying to get them both together.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you get them both together, then woof.
Yeah.
But the way that Brighton were able to do it with someone like Caicedo, we have the ability to do that. But it's like I said, you have to look at the makeup. So if you're going to play with him as the deepest player, because you're right, playing as the six is not the same. So you have different kinds of six. You have the deep lying playmaker six, your Thiago six, your Xabi Alonso six. But then you have your Biter six, your Caicedo six, your Mascherano six.
Your lone six, your double six.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like if you're going to play as the playmaker, as the deepest guy, you need to have a screener who's going to be, he can't be too detached.
Mm.
And so if we're going to have Mac as this deep line playmaker, it makes sense to have guys in and around him who have the aggression and the energy. So if Mac is a six, I kind of want any two of Gravenberch, Jones, Szoboszlai as the other two midfielders. Yeah. Like, yeah, that works. Because then what you're doing is you're hiding the weaknesses of that system and then you're maximising the strengths, yeah, which is basically what everyone's trying to do in all football games.
Yeah. Well, that what you've just said there depicts shades of Fabinho last season, really, in terms of we got to a point with Fabinho where the weaknesses that we'd been masking for years by surrounding him with marathon men, we were suddenly surrounding him with pensioners, and he looked suddenly like he was shattered and he couldn't cover the ground. It's because of the lads he's with. So, yeah, I think McAllister, for me, he's absolutely fine. I think he's still a great signing. I think he's going to be a great player for Liverpool, no issues regarding all that. Whether his future is as a six, there's a question mark there, depending on the system. And I think in 18 months' time, is he still in that spot? I don't think so. But
I mean, for me, I think it's one of those things where I wouldn't have him in that spot week in, week out, game in, game out. I think you could say that over the course of a season, he's going to play there more than other places. That's fine. But with the caveat of who else is in and around him. But then there's certain opponents where I feel like maybe you can take a little bit more leeway. So if you're looking at a midfield at home to Luton, then you're definitely going to have a midfield that's different than at home to Manchester City, for example.
Yeah.
So you can take more liberties in certain games. And I feel like that's where we're going to end up with Mac as the deepest line midfielder, is in a little bit more horses for courses in terms of who we're playing and who he's playing alongside.
Yeah.
Analysing Anfield on the Blood Red Channel.
I think he's it's an interesting one with him. You know, I don't think he's as much of a talking point as people are making out.
He's doing a better job, I think, at it. I think what we are doing is we're focusing on the moments where it goes wrong, partly because, you know, we saw a lot of that last season, and every time you see that, it's just like a big red flag. But also because those moments tend to be more noticeable because they lead to shots or goals.
Yeah.
So when you're the defensive midfielder and you make a mistake, it's like a goalkeeper. More often than not, it leads to a shot on goal or a chance. So they are going to stick in your head more. But we have to remember every single central midfielder has a risk and reward in their game. And it's just that at the moment, we're not mitigating the risk reward that he's having to deal with in a way that we could be. But I say again, I stress again, this is still relatively early in the season. Klopp is still figuring things out. And it's almost as if he's trying things to see if it works. But if it doesn't work, then he's kind of learnt something as well.
Yeah.
So maybe he can take that on to the next game.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth pointing out there that, like, you know, when we look at defensive numbers on this show, it tends to just be tackles and interceptions. And if you look at that for McAllister so far this season, he's sixth in the league for midfielders, tackles and interceptions per 90. If you have a guess who's top, long-term listeners of the show should know, it's Polina again.
Yeah.
By a mile.
And he didn't even start the season either.
No. He's only played about 5.3490s or something like that, but that's just enough to be counted in the sample that I used. Polina's on the top, but McAllister's sixth. More tackles and interceptions at the minute than Declan Rice,
yeah,
which is quite surprising for
and
me.
And I mean, he was involved in 12 duels and he won 50% of them against Brighton. And again, like, I feel like 50% duels, that's a decent number, but then when you add in the fact that he's doing 12 in a game, then that kind of really tells you that, he is having to put himself about probably the way that...
Yeah.
And this is the other thing about the whole conversation around him playing a six. There are times on the pitch where you look at his face and you feel like, you're not enjoying this,
Yeah. You can tell he's the kind of... He's a City player, I think. He's a Man City, Guardiola tempo player, as in everything's super slow. And you can tell when the game ramps up a little bit, he gets flushed in his face and things like that. He looks shattered. You know, the game after the jet lag against Wolves, he looked knackered.
Yeah.
So he's not that kind of player. He's a head in his mind. He's a head in his brain. But when it comes to the physical edge, he lets the ball do the running for him.
Yeah.
You know, he's not that.
And plenty of elite players have made that work for years, and so he's no different. The other thing I want to put into the mix about him, particularly this week, and some players, this won't be a problem, some will. He's a very shy character. You can definitely tell that he's a very shy character in and around. It was something that Brighton even said before he joined us. The attention he's had over the last week, playing against his brother, playing against his former club, literally being the guy who in front of everyone, the guy who all the articles are about.
Life.
Yeah, and I mean, I was watching him do his interview post-match after with Union with his brother, and it was just like, he's answered all of these questions like 50 times. Because I've seen about 50 different people asking this question. It's just like, all of that extra emotional energy, when you're in a situation like he is, where he's got a lot to think about, he's got a lot to worry about, and all that kind of thing. And then the extra spotlight that's on him already, that he would have known going into Brighton, the spotlight was going to be on him. Like, I don't think it's a situation where he was thinking, oh, I'm worried about my reception. He knew he was going to get a good reception, and he did. But he also knew that everyone was going to be jumping on him. He also knew that he's playing against guys who know him very well. So any kind of little extra things, tips and tricks about the way he plays, the way he wants to do things, they're going to have all that extra knowledge. And all of those things add into pressure. It doesn't affect every player, but I think when you're as introverted a character as him, it probably is going to affect him a bit.
Yeah, I think for me, even if he was doing worse than he currently is, for me, he gets a free pass. Just simply because of the role that he's occupying and how it's not really suited to his strengths and weaknesses. But despite that anyway, I would still have him in the team over Endo. There's been a bit of talk about that. I would still personally have McAllister in there. And I think, although he's not a six, a lone six, I think the crucial thing with replacing Fabinho, we needed a player, in my opinion, who was a holding player, a player who would hold and not someone who didn't want to be box to box all day. And if you think of Gravenberch, Jones, Szoboszlai, they all want to run in vertical straight lines and that. And McAllister is a bit more inclined to stay and hold the fort, even if he's not defensive minded particularly. So I think he suits the role to an extent enough for us to kind of get to maybe January where Andre comes in. I think Andre would be a player who would maybe take that spot up. Maybe not immediately, but over time. And then maybe McAllister becomes an eight then. But it's interesting.
I mean, I do think that if we're going to be playing Mac there, I do think that there's a scope to see the two of them together. I think if you ask Mac who's going to be a double pivot partner that's closest to what he's used to, it's Endo.
I think, but then Endo would be as a right back.
Yes.
That's the issue.
Yes, maybe. But then if we're doing the inverted fullback and we're pulling one of our centre backs out wide, then there's going to be cover behind him in that situation. So, like, for example, if it's obviously it's probably easier for Konate than if it's Matip. I mean, I was still a little bit nervous of Matip being so far against the touchline. But there again, with that system, there's a fail-safe into it. And the key is that if you have Endo in there as the winner, connected to Mac, and they're able to kind of move as a pair and dictate around the pitch, then you're mitigating. You're putting out some of the fires over there before they're reaching that point.
Yeah.
Analyzing Anfield on the Blood Red Channel.
It's one to keep an eye on, but I don't think he's been anywhere near as problematic as people are making out. And I think sometimes he's just made to look bad when he's beaten and he's kind of out the game because his recovery place isn't great. But other than that, I think he's doing quite well.
Also, we've kind of only not won three games all season. You should probably point that out as well.
That's a good point.
And the one that we did lose, well, we all know about that.
Definitely. But yeah, the Brighton game, I think after it I was a little bit frustrated, but I think looking back it was a decent point, and it was as fair as a result as you get. And I think both sides posted the next year of 2.3, which is interesting. That's a too old or I've ever seen one.
Exactly.
So yeah, we move on from that, and obviously we're currently in fourth, I think we are. Spurs are joint top with Arsenal. So if we look at the Premier League as a whole, is there any... We'll start with the top of the Premier League first. Is there anything overwhelming for you that surprised you more than anything, maybe?
Kind of. I think I've been surprised by Spurs' ability to dig out results when they aren't at their best. That's something that I thought would only come in the second half of the season. I thought they'd be able to get some points, and the positivity in the new system would kind of aid them. So they'd get a few 3-0s, a few 4-0s. I didn't think they'd get as many 1-0s and 2-1s as they're getting.
Yeah.
So that surprised me. I've not been as surprised with Arsenal. I suspected that Arteta would try to start tinkering with things.
Yeah.
And whether or not it helps them or not, in the short term, he sees the long-term vision and he's a better manager than I, so maybe we'll see. And yeah, maybe I expected Chelsea to get it together by now, but outside of that, no, everyone's kind of where I thought they'd be.
Yeah, it's really insistent up on the table. I think Spurs, I did think that he'd come on. And I think Postecoglou was going to surprise a lot of people. I didn't think they'd be top. but they have had the easiest fixtures.
They have.
So that's one to definitely factor in there. And I don't think they'll still be there, for example, at Christmas. You know, I think they'll be top four this season, though. I do think they'll finish top four.
They will certainly be in the mix. And they've got a lot of things in their favour in terms of, obviously, they're not in European football, so they'll have more time to plan. They won't get into a situation where they're having to play three games in a week back to back, which is something which a lot of the other teams in and around probably will do if they're still in European competition. So there's that in their favour. I do think this is still a very new team, and there aren't very many players in that squad, in that team, who are used to playing at the top of the league year in, year out. And so when it gets tight towards the end of the season, that might come into it. And we haven't really seen the situation now yet where you think, look at it and you think, yeah, they could have done with Harry Kane in that game.
Yeah.
And that's going to come because like you don't have someone as dominant in a team as that and take him out and it's just fine forever. Like it's just, you might get a bit of a short-term burn, but there's going to come a point when they're like, yeah, we could have done with him here. And that's coming. But again, I feel like there are certain teams that are going to get better as the season goes on, like Aston Villa, who've started well. I do think that, again, they're one that they will get better as the season goes on. Newcastle have started to get themselves together again, so I think that they're going to go on a decent run between now and Christmas time. Obviously, they've started brilliantly in the Champions League, which, again,
they were very fortunate against Milan, though.
They were, but then you've got to ride your luck sometimes.
Yeah, and yeah, yeah.
I think that the other thing we need to remember is that as painful as it is to watch Newcastle do well in the Champions League, it's actually a benefit to us.
Yeah.
Because the way that the UEFA coefficient goes, the two best performing countries get an extra place in the Champions League.
Yeah.
And if they do well, then the chances are the fifth becomes Champions League place this season. Mm. So, yeah.
Cool. And if they go deep, it means they've got more to worry about rather than Premier League football. So.
Exactly.
But I think Manchester City at an interesting talking point, because I must be honest, when I seen the fixtures, first eight games, I thought they would be top, and I thought to an extent where I looked at our fixtures and thought we just need to have to be roughly within touching distance. We're 1 point behind them, and they've had a much easier start than us. And if you look at the numbers as well, they are interesting. Like, it's very early to be doing this. It's too early to be doing this, to be honest. But for shots, City have been known for their attack, obviously, it's Pep Guardiola team. Erling Haaland up front and all this. For shots per 90, shots per match or whatever, they are fourth in the Premier League for that. And in terms of expected goals per 90, excluding penalties, eighth. This is a Manchester City team that haven't really got going yet.
No.
They've got a few injuries, to be fair to
them. I was just going to say, it's funny because normally we don't even really think about that with Manchester City, because you think, okay, well, they've always got a great other player to be off the bench and come in. Mm-hmm. And to be fair, you look at the introduction of Jeremy Doku, and he already looks like a guy who's going to be really useful for them and really productive for them. But the simple fact of the matter is that as good as their squad is, as great as they are, they don't have another Kevin De Bruyne, and they don't have another Rodri.
Yeah.
And
well, you could argue they don't even have another Gundogan.
No.
At the minute.
And to be missing all three of those at the same time,
yeah,
it's always going to have an effect. And when you've got a guy like Haaland who is so good at being the finishing point, but you're not, I mean, you can ask him to get involved in the build-up play and bring him into midfield, but you are kind of losing some of what he's good at. So you're kind of sacrificing another player in and around it already from a team who are used to playing as a false nine. So everybody is technically a midfielder. So you're taking the three dominant midfielders out. You're losing one in terms of numbers when you've got a guy so high up the pitch. And suddenly, the teams are able to deal with him in midfield. Like, I think of the West Ham game and how comfortably Pakatar and Ward-Prowse were able to get on the ball, and Alvarez was playing in that game as well, how comfortably they were able to get on the ball in space and turn and go towards Man City's goal. And that's the thing you're not normally meant to be able to do. So whether or not they'll start to get players back and then suddenly they'll look like themselves again, they have proven how reliant even the best team are on a certain couple of individuals.
Yeah, well, do you still have comfortably the best defence in the league in terms of the underlying numbers, just in terms of shots faced, expected goals against and things like that. But in just in terms of the attack, again, it's very, very early for this, but in terms of the attack, it doesn't look as threatening as previous years. And if you can kill the supply lines of Haaland, maybe, and place an emphasis on some of these new lads like a Kovacic or a Matthias Nunes or even a Doku, you know, to kind of break the block, which they haven't been accustomed to doing over the past couple of years. I think Doku's from Rennes, isn't he? And Matthias Nunes from Wolves, obviously. So it's one to keep an eye on, but I still think with Guardiola in charge, you're guaranteed a minimum of 85 points anyway, so they will be up there. But I don't think, it's early for me to say this, but I'm not sure that they are as much of a given as previous
years. It's strange because it's almost like if you look at it from their point of view and you look at the opponents they're up against, with all due respect, like the Arsenal and Liverpool and Spurs of this season are nowhere near as good challengers as the Liverpool of 18-19, 19-20, and even to say a little bit of the 21-22 as well. So City themselves don't have to be as high. Like, they know that. Whether or not they'll admit it openly, they know that. Subconsciously, they know that. They don't have to be at those heights. And this is already coming off a season where they had to be so good for so long in order to win the treble. So the idea of there being at least a subconscious mental drop-off or an easing off, at least in the beginning of the season, you can kind of see where that would come from. But again, like you say, this is all relative. We're not saying that they're going to fall off a cliff.
No. But I think it's interesting as well, I've just noticed Arsenal in attack, 12th for expected goals per 90 per match. So that's really interesting as well. That's one to keep an eye on. That's one thing that Liverpool definitely have. Liverpool definitely have a firing attack, and we are fifth by these numbers, which is, we would be top if without the red cards.
Yeah.
You know, the red cards are the reason we aren't top, basically. So that's one to keep an eye on. And we'll round up this week's episode by talking about Man United, because why not?
Make everyone feel a little bit better about themselves, why not?
Yeah, well, I think going into the season, to be fair, I think we tipped them to do all right, largely because they'd upgraded the goalkeeping department to a player who could kick the ball. But for whatever reason, he's collapsed in terms of his actual goalkeeping. Believe me, he is not as bad he's looked.
No.
So I don't know what is happening to him. Gary Neville, to be fair, touches on this, doesn't he? Gary Neville always says, like, it's the most pressurised position in England and that, and it feels like he's a bit Man United biased with it. But I don't know what Onana's doing lately. He looks like a shambles, mate, really, to be fair.
Again, I feel like it's he's a very confident fella. And I did say before he came in there were going to be times he was going to make mistakes, but the good thing about him is he is able to brush them off. However, in this environment, all mistakes are magnified. Now, obviously, playing for Inter Milan's a massive club in Italy. There's going to be lots of scrutiny, lots of people on his back every time he makes a mistake. But even within that, that was in the context of them being a very good team, still winning most of their games, and still having a team that functioned and a game plan that worked. So even when you had bad times, you could shake it off and say, we believe in the process. United don't have any of that. They are still searching for someone to come in, be really good, and save them. Mm. That's really what they're looking for. They want someone to come in and be like, oh, thank God we got a really good player here now, then we can do everything. Because that's literally what happened last season with Casemiro. The problem is that they got 1 year out of Casemiro.
Yeah. I remember saying this at the time, you know, honestly, they're getting him in world class and all that, but he was like 30 when they got him. You're getting an immediate impact sound, but then as the likes of Rashford improves, you know, all these, Bruno Fernandes maybe improves a little bit, that's when Casemiro declines. So yous aren't all peaking together. So you're not going to win a league. So, but if you look at their current situation, it is interesting. I mean, over the weekend, obviously they found a way to win, but it doesn't mean anything because they didn't deserve it. They played with an entire team of right footers. Luke Shaw, Lisandro, both injured, and Anthony, I think, came on late in the game. So that is an interesting thing as to why they maybe suffered a little bit. I think Hoyland up front looks decent, but he's adding a different dynamic, and I think he's maybe... I don't think he's overly benefiting Rashford at the minute.
No, because
they both want to run in behind, and it's a bit like Nunes maybe with a lad who also wants to run in behind, as opposed to... I think Rashford would benefit from Firmino, basically.
The irony is, you know the guy who would really help Hoyland better than anyone in that Man United attack? Sancho.
Yeah.
He's the guy who wants to go out wide and put the ball in, put early balls in to a striker. Hoyland wants to get in there, in amongst the centre-backs. He wants to stretch the play. He wants to fight for balls in and around the six-yard box. I think if you got those two playing together regularly in confident form, you start to see a better relationship. But unfortunately, for whatever reason, that doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon. And then, again, it's about complementary football, like we were saying with Liverpool, like we always say. If you've got players who are definitely going to play, and Man United have a few of those, if you think about Fernandes and you think about Hoyland, and now you probably have to add Rashford into that mix, that means that everybody else has to do what you aren't getting from those players. And I'm not sure they've got the personnel who can do that. Yeah. I mean, in a situation where even someone like Amrabat, who you think would be able to go in there and help them, they're having to play him a left back.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think he had a decent debut as well, but the second game, he was just getting the offside line right and things like that was difficult with him and things, but they are currently 10th. They've conceded 12 goals, which is more than anyone else, apart from Brighton, to be fair, but they're not doing particularly well, and long may it continue.
Yeah, and the beauty of it is I don't think that they're going to do anything in terms of removing Ten Hag.
No.
For at least 6 months. At least. If we get to March and it still looks as messy as this and they're out of the competitions, then they probably will start to think about it. But, yeah, between now and then, it's going to be his mess to deal with.
Yeah, it's one to keep an eye on, and we'll be back next week to preview the Merseyside derby, which should be a tasty one.
Oh, yes.
But, yeah, thanks for tuning in this week, and we will see you then.
You've been listening to Analyzing Anfield from the Liverpool Echo's Blood Red Channel.